yourself so you can buy more. What do you care about bluffing people? Does it make you want to try more? What do you care about nothing, people, when you're waiting at the bus stop?
We know what you mean, we know what you've seen, we understand.
I'm very glad to hear that.
We know what you mean, we know what you've seen, we understand.
We understand the sky will be visible soon. Understand the sky will be visible soon.
Kevin Ayers, another track from Odd Ditties, Soon, Soon, Soon. Before that, Parquet Courts, Tears of Plenty from Light Up Gold. Depth and Current preceded that from a 7-inch. It's called Make It Home. Moira Scar from a CD called Scarred for Life. We heard Misfunction. We opened that set with Robert Calvert, Widowmaker from the Captain Lockheed and the Starfighters LP. And we've got just enough time to listen to one more song by Kevin Ayers as we say goodbye to him. Passed away last week at 68. Thanks for listening, everybody. This is Scott. You're tuned to Freeform Radio, WFMU. Jason Siegel will be hosting Radio Free Culture in just a couple minutes. I'll see you next week at the marathon. One final track from Kevin Ayers coming right up.
This is the last one from Kevin Ayers and Archibald. And we hope this will tuck you nicely into bed with a bit of gentle nostalgia. I'm sure you know the tune.
Help it, girl. flutter to me like moths around their flame. And if their wings burn, I am not to blame. I'm falling in love again, never wanted to. What am I to do? I can't help it. To me like moths around a flame. And if their wings burn, I am not to blame. Just falling in love again, never wanted to. What am I to do? I can't help it. Falling in love again, I never wanted to. But what am I to do? I can't help it. Falling in love again, never wanted to. What am I to do? I can't help it.
This is WFMU in East Orange, WMFU Mount Hope, Rockland County at 91.9 FM and online at WFMU.org. Welcome, this is Radio Free Culture, show from WFMU about the intersection of music, art, and technology. And today we'll be talking about artist revenue streams. It's a immense project from the Future of Music Coalition. We'll be joined by Gene Cook, who is the director of programs at the Future of Music Coalition, and a co-director of the study, as well as a musician. We'll also be joined by musicians Greg Fox and Rebecca Gates. We'll be with you in just one moment here. In the background, we're listening to Yacht and an instrumental version of Shangri-La. So welcome to Radio Free Culture. My name is Jason Siegel, and I'm joined by Gene Cook. Gene, how are you?
I'm doing pretty good. How are you?
Doing pretty good. The director, the co-director of this of the study, Artist Revenue Streams, and Greg Fox is here with us as well.
Hello.
Greg, how's it going?
Good.
And then calling in from Portland is Rebecca Gates. Rebecca, how are you?
Oh, I'm great.
So we're talking about artist revenue streams, which is the first ever study of how do musicians make money from music. And there's been a lot of
people have a lot of opinions about this. We hear a lot of anecdotes, and this is really the first time that there has been such a comprehensive study of how musicians actually earn income and how it's changing over time. So, Gene, you are also the director of programs at the Future Music Coalition, who sort of came up with this idea. And how did the idea come about? Why do you think this had not been done before?
Well, I think that people have measured how artists are doing. That's an area of great interest, I think, to the field, since the internet was such a disruptive force, and people want to understand how musicians are impacted by a lot of changes in the industry. And so in the past, these studies have been done, but they've been done of specific populations. So, there are folks like the unions, like the American Federation of Musicians. They'll do studies of their members, or ASCAP or BMI will do studies of their members, or NARIS, which is the Grammys. It's a National Academy of Recording Arts and Sciences. They'll do a study of their members. What makes our study distinct, actually, is that instead of sticking to one particular membership, we kind of opened it up. Anybody who said that they were a musician, 18 or older, had a certain number of credits, a U.S. citizen, was free to take the survey. And we worked with 100 partners nationally, ranging from national service organizations to like kind of local affinity groups, to spread the word about the survey. And so we were able to collect information from a very diverse group of musicians that was diverse in terms of genre, in terms of age, in terms of the roles that they played and the experiences that they had, and of course in terms of their income.
So, I mean, even before you started the survey, which ended up getting more than 5,000 responses, is that?
That's right. We had 5,300 completes.
Wow. But you, even before starting the survey, had sort of identified like 25 different types of artists.
Sure, absolutely. I mean, I think a lot of this started a few years ago when we sat around and said, well, how many different revenue streams are there for musicians? And we sat down and we made a list. We're like, well, when you tour, that's money. And when you get money like an advance from a record label, that's another income stream. When you get money from radio airplay, that's an income stream, merchandise. So we made a list, about 29, and we wrote a blog post about it, and we called it the 29 streams. And, as is kind of typical, if you go on the internet and you say, I think that this might be the way things are, there are a lot of people who will show up and tell you why you're wrong. And in our particular case, there are a lot of really helpful people who helped us break it down, clarify different income streams. In the end, we ended up with about 42. And we used those 42 to be the basis of the survey. Now, the survey that you mentioned that 5,300 people took is one part of our research. In addition to the quantitative data that we were able to gather, which is really, really compelling because so many people did take the survey. We also have some very, very good qualitative data. We interviewed about 80 different kinds of musicians, and we also have, we've published 5 case studies so far of individual artists that actually looks at their real numbers. We're talking about thousands and thousands of pages of record label statements and ASCAP statements and tour receipts. And
that's a lot to keep track of.
It's a lot to keep track of.
Most artists don't think to keep track of these types of things.
It's really funny. When we were putting this project together, we realized that the only way this was actually going to happen, that we could capture this information, is we had to be willing to go to people's houses and, they point us to the corner that they never go into with that box that just has everything in it that they've never really looked through, never had the time to, but always kind of knew that maybe they should hold on to it. And, in some cases, people can just get their accountant to send us a Quicken file, which is great, too. But I think that some of the more interesting stories are from the people who don't have the kind of capacity to have an accountant to send you the Quicken file. And, having to dig through crates and crates and crates of information is also one of the things that we built into the study to be willing to do. Now, the thing that you were asking about, which is the 21 different kinds of musicians, when we were deciding who to interview, mm-hmm. We wanted to make sure that we were mapping the field in an appropriate way, that we were asking people these questions, but that we weren't asking all the same kind of musician. So we thought about the different roles that a musician could have. So a musician can be a performer, they could be a composer, they can be a recording artist, they can be a session musician, and then there are a few different roles as well that we kind of figured out. But even within those roles, if you kind of filter it by genre, you'll find that the income streams for these musicians will be really different. So for a composer, for example, you might think that, oh, well, if you're a composer who doesn't perform, maybe your income streams are kind of going to always be the same. But then you think about it a little further and you're like, well, there's like a symphony composer and they're getting like commissions and stuff. But then there's also like a jingle composer and they're getting commissions of a sort, but it's really different. And they're more likely to get performance royalties if they're, you know, writing jingles for broadcast. And then there are people who compose for film. There are people who are like Nashville songwriters, people who write hits. Like, and those are just four examples of composers who may not perform. And we're talking about actually many, many different kinds of income streams, and they're all really different from each other. So that's why it was really important for us to start out when we were figuring out who we were going to interview, to start out by mapping as much as we could. Now, this is not a definitive list of the 21, mm-hmm. but it was definitely a place for us to get started.
So probably a lot of musicians out there are listening, and hopefully by the end of the show, we're going to have some answers for you based on what type of musician you are, what is the magic amount of you know, these different activities that I'm sort of joking, Gene, but what are some of the trends that we're starting to see as we go through the data?
Well, the interesting thing about the data is that, you know, we are kind of buried in it. There's a lot. You know, every person who took the survey took between 20 and 120 questions. They answered between 20 and 120 questions. And when you think about that, plus there's over 5,000 people that took the survey, we're talking about hundreds of thousands of data points that we've been collecting from the survey alone. And then we've got the thousands of pages of financial records and also of the transcripts as well. And one thing to remember with this data set is that there's a lot that you can glean from it, about relationships of musicians to various income streams, and how when you filter it by genre or by role, how things change. And now we're actually about to do a location analysis, which I think is going to be really interesting, looking at musicians from music cities versus non-music cities. And in our case, we're defining music city as like New York, Los Angeles, Nashville, places like that. But all of these things are just a snapshot. Mm-hmm. So they're a snapshot of a particular point in time, particular experiences. We are able to map out things like get a sense of, say, what a jazz musician's income is if they're not in the union, and then you can put it on a chart, like by age, and you see like a curve. But that's not a curve over time of an individual musician. That's a snapshot of people, young people and old people, who are all kind of working jazz musicians. It's the only information we have about trends is what people are reporting to us. So they'll say, well, I think that this income has gone up or down in the last 5 years.
There was a question about, and you this know, is, how has it changed in the last 5 years?
Yeah, absolutely. And so I think that that's just one kind of grain of salt that we need to put out there, which is that you can tell a lot of stories from the data that we have, but all of the stuff that we're talking about in terms of how things have changed are based on people's perceptions of what have changed. And sometimes people's perceptions, especially around money, it's not always the clearest way of really understanding what has changed. So it can really just suggest ideas of how things might have changed, but it isn't necessarily any kind of facts that we're gathering from it. Mm-hmm. That said, everybody noticed that the internet happened.
Yes.
And that's changed a lot of things for some people. Obviously, the method of distribution for recordings has changed. The platforms that you can release your music through have changed. How you develop audiences have changed. But how it's impacted people depends on what roles they play. So, for example, if you're a session musician, probably your income hasn't really changed all that much because people still need you to go to shows. You don't really have a brand that you need to maintain. So a lot of the new internet platforms don't necessarily apply to you. Versus if you are a songwriter and a leader of a band, a lot of things have changed. We're also finding that by genre, things are really different. I think that for jazz and for classical folks, when we take a look at their comfort level with technology, they're kind of consistently across the board less comfortable in using the internet to promote their music and to distribute their music and to collaborate with others and to develop relationships with fans. Now, in the case
you seem to be very much in one foot in the new classical world, kind of newer, less traditional forms of classical music. It seems that maybe there are musicians who are using technology in more effective ways.
Definitely. I mean, I think you're going to find exceptions to every rule mm-hmm. that you're kind of coming away from the data with, for sure. I think that overall, just based on these are the survey numbers, so the people who took our survey, of those people, that the classical people tended to be less comfortable across the board. And I think that for the most part, it makes sense because many of those people were in symphony orchestras, for example, or, you know, there were session musicians. And so for them, the need to engage in a lot of these technologies, I think it's just a different kind of a situation. It's not like they have fans that they're necessarily trying to develop for their symphony orchestra. The symphony orchestra's management tends to do that kind of work, not the individual members of the orchestra. So the structure of that particular genre can be different. You're right, though, that there are a lot of crossover groups, a lot of new music groups, chamber music groups that that are certainly on the edge of, you know, they use technology on a regular basis to communicate with their friends. It's just a natural way of expressing yourself. And so, of course, you are going to see many folks from the classical and the jazz field that are engaging in this space. But I would say that overall, if you were to look at an aggregate of a lot of people's experience, which is what the survey does, is that we're seeing that they're a little bit behind.
Well, it's you know, speaking of kind of this before and after the internet, I want to get Rebecca Gates, who released Rebecca. You first released music in 1993 with the Spinanes.
Yeah, and we released we did two 7-inches in 91 with a small label in Portland called Imp Records, and then the first album came out in 1993 with Sub Pop.
And you know, you had this fantastic album, The Float, that came out last year on your own label and also split with the label 12XU. But that was actually your first release in 11 years, right? And I'm wondering, you know, if what was your inspiration to get involved in the Artist Revenue Streams project? Because you were involved at the beginning doing some interviews and.
Yeah, well, basically, I've been fortunate to be involved with the Future Music Coalition over a couple of years, just volunteering and, you know, helping them with their work and being inspired by their work. And when I came, I quit releasing, I quit working actively in the music business for a while. I still kept releasing some little tracks here and there and touring a lot and guest vocal and guest playing on people's albums. But from 2001 to last year, I didn't actually release my own record. And so when I decided to release the record, I started working on it I'd been working on it, recording it for some time, but when I got to the point where I wanted to release in about 2010, late 2010 or 2011, I was looking at a lot of different modes to release the record, because basically in the time since I had put out my last record, as Gene says, the internet had happened, you know, and it was a very different scene, and a lot of it was really inspiring, and it felt like there were a lot of potentials, but it also felt like there were certain resources that should be available that weren't available. So I was kind of mulling a lot of things over on my own, and just in terms of my personal practice. And Gene and Kristen had actually been working on the survey for quite a while before I came in, but I was very fortunate to be brought in for a period of time and assist with some of the interviews and help them think through, along with a group of people, the online survey and start getting some of the stories from musicians and some of the details and case studies as well.
Yeah. Now, Rebecca, something that we talked about sort of off mic is, you know, in different styles of music, it's like not, it's not cool to talk about money necessarily. And you sort of have the Northwest punk background where that wasn't part of, maybe it wasn't as much part of a conversation as maybe it should be.
Well, I think that's something that's really amazing about the survey, and what it offers is that there are, as Gene has touched on, so many different experiences by musicians in similar genres, and then there's a wide range of experiences from a musician. There is no one story, really, and there is an aggregate of experience, but there's just a lot of different exceptions. But one of the things that was interesting for me as I started talking to musicians as part of the survey, and then just in terms of my own work, there's a lot of sort of cultural conditioning that are part of different genres. And so even in terms of treating your own work as an independent musician, sort of as a small business, or actually kind of stepping up and saying, "Yeah, I've put these in, and these are my expenses, and here's my return," or whatever. That's something that a lot of, at least in my world, a lot of indie rockers or rock and rollers or just sort of independent musicians in any genre are slow to come to and are maybe uncomfortable speaking about. And there was always a huge question, you know, of like, are you selling out, you know, from fans? I mean, it was just always kind of like you should just be not thinking in terms of a business or not thinking in terms of the money that you are making. Whereas there's other genres where that's just not even a question. You know, if you're going to show up and you're going to play in a symphony, or you're going to play in a jazz commission, you're going to do these things like here's the setup, and then in hip hop there's definitely a lot more comfort in talking about money and making money in different ways of strategizing across different revenue streams. And that was something that was really interesting to me as I started hearing stories and working on the survey.
Well, this idea of sort of selling out, I think, has changed a lot as the source of financial support for musicians has really shifted from that there was kind of this old model where a label would give an artist an advance and help fund their work in a studio. And is that something that is happening these days? I feel like there's like the Converse recording studio where brands are actually kind of supporting musicians rather than,
well,
than record labels.
It's a complicated, it's a hydra of different scenarios. But I think that there's definitely still labels that exist, both small and large, that are following a sort of traditional business model with their artists in terms of advances and ownership and expectations. There's small labels who are doing variations on a theme. There's musicians that don't, that there's no label and you're just doing it on your own. And also, there are commercial, so there's not really necessarily that binary, us or them, or you're independent or you're major. I mean, it's just really a variety of experiences. And what's something we saw in the survey is that in many ways this shift has been really positive, and in other ways it's been negative, and the perceptions differ around according to each musician. The thing that's interesting is that sync licensing and commission for ads and placement has become such a huge part of how musicians, some musicians can have some income, additional income. But one of the things that's interesting is that was, that was absolutely frowned on. That was the ultimate sellout, in a lot of ways. And so it's interesting, when I was releasing records with Sub Pop, someone who sold a song to The Gap, it was just like criminal, and now that's something that is, ads are a way that are covering some of the scarcity in broadcast medium. Some people might hear a song on an ad more than they're going to hear it on their FM radio station.
I want to get Greg in here a little bit. We've got this big list of 42 different revenue streams, started out as 29, and by the end of the survey, it reached 42. And Greg, I invited you to the program because just seeing that you were actually kind of doing a whole bunch of these, from plane shows to, I think you have sponsorship for drumsticks, right?
I wish. I have a cymbal endorsement.
Cymbals. Oh, that's
yeah.
That's probably
better. Which doesn't mean you get them for free. It means you just can pay less. And then sometimes they'll give you a cymbal after a couple of years or two or something like this.
You're also playing in so many different projects, as ranging from roles as a composer to, you just toured Japan, right? With the group Z's.
Yes, and I was playing solo shows there too.
Ah, cool. So what has, what sort of drives your approach to music, and are you thinking of these different revenue streams as you're doing it, or is that kind of just like on the side, you know? Hey,
I'm not really thinking specifically about revenue streams when I'm thinking about taking opportunities or not, or following, you know, or stepping through doors as they open, or however you'd want to put it. I just sort of weigh things as they come and judge them to be worth the time and effort or not. And sometimes there's a bit of time where you can kind of feel it out and decide whether or not it's going to be worthwhile or not.
It seems like you are right now, you're playing a show every night.
I think five or six this week. Yeah.
That's a busy schedule.
Yeah. Well, the short answer to how I make money as a professional musician is I play a lot.
You play a lot.
I mean, you know, and that takes a lot of different forms, but it works for me. To a certain extent, it works. It could work a lot better, but it's working, and it's getting better and better. The more attention and effort I put into it, the more rewarding it is in many ways, not the least of which, you know, as far as it being something that supports me, paying my rent and stuff.
It's so you've, can we just kind of get a sense of some of the different roles that you've played? You've done commissioned work?
Yeah.
What are some examples of that?
I have done music for a couple different video games, video game soundtracks, and I've done some music for film soundtracks as well. As far as commissions go, that covers it. Mostly video game stuff I've done.
I guess the cool thing about that type of work is it kind of a one-time commission, or is it something where you're getting royalties as the video game is sold or downloaded?
Well, I think that depends on the situation. I don't know if there's a way that's done, but in my experience, one of the games I did, I was paid a flat fee to do it. Basically they were buying from me the right to use the music in a game. I maintained the rights to the music to use however I wanted, basically, but they would use it in this for this game. And then in another for a while I was working with an independent video game developer, so for most of that there wasn't any money, but we actually then won an award for what was called the Nuovo Award at the Independent Game Developers Conference, which was a cash prize awarded for, originality in game design, art and music within the game design.
And I bet you had no idea how to divide that up. You had something you hadn't talked about.
Well, that kind of opens up a bit of a longer story, but.
Okay. Well, we don't have to go down.
Yeah, I mean, there were only two of us working on the game, so it seemed pretty clear. But I think that kind of shed some light on one of the sort of like lessons I've learned along the road of doing this, which is that it's very important to work out financial aspects of work before you do the work. I mean, I think that applies to like everything. I don't think that's just something about music or making money as a musician or like something like that. I think that applies to like any time you're doing work where you're working with people and there's money involved. I think it's generally good practice to you know, get that discussion out of the way beforehand as opposed to after the fact.
Yeah. Well, that sort of relates to something that Gene has been talking about, which is leverage, the idea of how, I mean, leverage is at least in the way that you've been talking about it, seems to be more kind of the big picture of who negotiates, kind of behind the scenes, what you are as a composer or as a recording artist, what you're getting paid for, like a Spotify stream. Gene, what is this leverage, and how does the new data that we have possibly inform these percentage points and things
sure.
like that?
Sure. I mean, I think that one of the most striking takeaways from our work with this data is that, you know, future music, we're not just researchers looking at income. We do a lot of work in the policy space, and we pay attention to new business models, and we understand how the music industry works. And that one of the things that kind of struck us was that of all the different income streams, that there are definitely some that the artist is able to kind of negotiate on their own behalf. And, you know, things like if you're teaching, for example, you can set the rate that you're going to get paid by your student or by the school that you're working for. Or if you're, you know, winning a prize or something like that, like the Nuovo Award, like that's a set amount of money. It's not like you're going to have to negotiate that. But then there's this other category of income that actually the rate gets negotiated and the artist isn't really involved in setting that rate. So it's not like the person either offers what they offer or the artist sets it. It's like this other party that comes in and sets those rates. And a lot of the new business models that are developing now, things like Spotify, things like Pandora, even iTunes and how mechanical royalties are set, all of that stuff is done by middlemen. And that when, as we were mapping through the space, we were discovering, well, not discovering, because I think that we kind of knew it all along, but we started to document how not all middlemen kind of operate in the same kind of way. So you have people like ASCAP and BMI and CSAC who collect performance royalties for composers. And so when your film score gets played in, you know, in a cinema in Italy or whatever, somebody collects money in Italy and sends it over to ASCAP, BMI, or CSAC, whoever you're registered with, and you get the money. But in addition to that, you know, if you want to, I think right now, if you want to do any kind of streaming in general, you do have to talk to ASCAP, BMI, and CSAC about their catalogs, about getting permission to do so. So Spotify pays ASCAP, and Pandora pays ASCAP, and that's. And so those are two examples, and that ASCAP sets the rates. You know, they get together and they do these private negotiations and they figure out what the rate is, or ASCAP actually might just decide what the rate's going to be through rate court. There's all these different processes. So that's kind of one example of middlemen. ASCAP would be one. Sound Exchange would be another. They collect for performers. So when music gets played on digital radio, so that would be like a webcast, a webcast of WFMU, mm-hmm. as one example, or Sirius XM, or actually there are these weird channels on cable television that don't have video but only have music, like they also pay.
My parents like those.
Yeah. Well, musicians make money from that. So anyway, that's what Sound Exchange collects for, and they have a process that goes through the Copyright Royalty Board where a lot of lawyers get together and they argue with each other about, you know, why music services are ripping off artists or how artists are killing music services, and then the judges decide how much the rate's going to be. And then there's this whole other category of middlemen, which is like the major labels. So the major labels set what the rate is for Spotify. And that what we noticed when we were looking at these different middlemen is that they're not all the same, and that the royalty collecting agencies like Sound Exchange or BMI, ASCAP, and in some cases the unions, AFM or AFTRA, they might kind of negotiate what people are going to get paid for, like TV uses or something like that. So of all the middlemen, the major labels actually end up being slightly problematic slightly problematic middlemen, because a lot of what they do is secret. A lot of what they do is negotiated completely privately. There's NDAs associated, non-disclosure agreements associated with putting these deals together. And that when it comes to issues of, you know, like publishing the rate, okay, so that's not known. Although, you know, if you're going to negotiate with some of the other middlemen, you do tend to know what the rate is, even if it is complicated and hard to understand. So the rate's not published. The payment structures, like major labels have a history of being unreliable payment agents, for example. And so you don't know how much you're supposed to get paid. And then when they do pay you, they're not very clear about what it is that they're paying you for. And part of this has all kind of boiled down to a concept of leverage. And so we put a presentation together that kind of talks about the idea of leverage, that that major labels, as one example, they have a lot of leverage with a lot of new music services that want to develop, because all the new music services need to get their permission, for the most part, to operate. They need their permission to use their catalogs, and that's a leverage point for them. Another example of leverage would be like, if I was the only violin player in town, and then all of a sudden, like, 10 bands came through town and they all need a violin player, I have a lot of leverage. If I'm the only violin player, I can charge whatever I want. So leverage is kind of based on scarcity a little bit, but sometimes it's also about being able to demonstrate that you have a certain amount of power as well. And so this is a really interesting concept for us, because for the most part, individual musicians don't have leverage. And the only way they get leverage is by banding together with other musicians. And so that's why folks like ASCAP, BMI, and CSAC, people like the unions, AFM and AFTRA, people like Sound Exchange, even though you know, these are large bureaucratic organizations in some cases, and they're not perfect. Sometimes they have their problems. But ultimately, if you were to ask me, like, in terms of, like, is it good for musicians or bad for musicians, I'll always say that it's good for musicians, because for individual musicians to be able to build the kind of power so that they can actually negotiate what rates are going to be paid, when you're looking at these new business models, is always a positive thing. You really don't, I mean, just as my personal opinion, this is not the opinion of our study, and it's not the opinion of Future Music Coalition necessarily.
I mean, you are also a musician and have a, I think, a really important personal perspective
Well, I mean, I just don't, I mean, like, in the case of Spotify, for example, like, when Spotify finally got licensed in the United States, they set the rate, the major labels basically set the rate that was going to get paid. I don't think the independent labels really had much of a say in what the rate was going to be. It was really the major labels that kind of set the table for that. And, you know, the rate that they ended up negotiating, I think, was probably lower than what it could have been, in part because they took an equity stake in Spotify. So when Spotify profits, the major labels get paid, and which is kind of interesting. It ends up driving the royalty rate down, but they get the same amount of money. And the thing about an equity stake is that, you know, does any of that end up trickling back down to the artists? Because the reason why the labels are at this table in the first place is because they've aggregated the copyright of, you know, millions of artists. And so it's really unclear as to whether or not these equity stakes are going to end up getting passed on to the artists. It was also unclear back, like, 5 years ago or 10 years ago, when the labels were, like, suing everybody. It's like, what happened to all the money that they collected from the people that they considered pirates in that big campaign to sue all the fans of music? You know, is that ending up getting paid to individual artists? They're unreliable payment agents. So this is just kind of one of those kind of categorical things for me, which is that, you know, if there isn't a lot of transparency, if there isn't kind of clear reporting to individual artists, you know, if there isn't any kind of artist oversight over a process, then I just feel like it's going to be disadvantaging individual artists.
Let's take just a quick break, and we are going to be back. We have some great comments happening right now at WFMU.org. One is from Droll, who says, "So far, this conversation seems to be about how musicians need to change their expectations to match the world as it is today." I guess that's from when we were talking about, you know, oh, but that was before the internet. But Droll is saying, actually, sites like YouTube legitimize the theft by knowingly allowing unauthorized copies. This is the root of the problem. So let's hear just a little bit of, this is actually a project that Gene Cook is involved with, called Antisocial Music, and we'll be back with Gene Cook, Greg Fox, and Rebecca Gates here in just a minute. Thank you. And we're back here on Radio Free Culture. This is Antisocial Music. That's a Gene, can you tell us a little bit about this piece? It's actually a cover, I guess, or collaboration with Dialect from right here in New Jersey.
Right. It's a collaboration with Dialect. It's a piece that they wrote for Antisocial Music. So ASM is a chamber music group that's based in New York City. It's been around for about 12 years, and we've been collaborating with people who work kind of outside of the conventional indie rock genre, but have really, really big ideas. And so some of the stuff that we've done in the past include, like, you know, a multimedia indie opera, like 12 years ago, and then most recently this recording, which is a collaboration with Dialect. They created the music. We figured out how to get a live orchestra to play it. We've done it live a few times. It's always a great experience because it's a 19-minute kind of very, very, very loud, low-end, kind of drony, very, very scary piece. And yeah. And when you listen to it, you have to turn it up really, really loud because that's kind of the experience of Dialect live. And they were really surprised when we ended up performing it for the first time because they didn't really think about how acoustic instruments could kind of get that same kind of a feeling. And of course, the acoustic instruments had help, like octave pedals and different kinds of amplification. But it was a really fun project to put together.
So it's actually up as a Pay What You Want download on Bandcamp. And it's also a limited LP, it looks like. But I would like to talk about kind of this balance between the Pay What You Want download and physical sales. You know, what was some of the... And also there's a track that I hope to have queued up from Guardian Alien that's also a free download via the label, via Thrill Jockey. You know, what's... Droll has this great comment on the playlist page saying that it's not about musicians who need to adapt to having their work stolen. Talk about why fans force musicians to justify getting paid for their work. And that's sort of an intense comment from Droll. But I'm wondering what was the thought process to make that track available for free?
Well, we had put it together actually as we weren't going to make it available online at all. Initially, it's 180 gram vinyl. It's like a really, really nice LP pressing that we've done, and it actually comes with like a paperboard sculpture by Scrapworm, who's one of the artists that we've worked with over the years, and it kind of like folds out into a cube. It's kind of this physical product that we've created. It's an art piece. It's a limited edition art piece. And then kind of somewhere along the line, when we were putting this together, we always anticipated that it would just be something that we would give, you know, that we would sell to people as an art piece. But we were actually taking everything that we've done and we're like, you know, maybe we should just put everything online and make it available. We document all of our performances. And one of the things that we do a lot of contemporary music, like people who are in the 20s and 30s who want to write really weird music. For classically trained musicians who can also improvise, like, they come to us, we play their music, and part of what we do is, I think, that we document it. So then I think there was just kind of a point at which we all looked at each other and we're like, well, let's just put everything online. And that's when we put the Bandcamp account together, and it just seemed to make sense to make this piece available as well, because it's hard to explain what it is without listening to it.
Yeah.
And we
without listening to the whole thing, I'm sorry to just play an excerpt. I also want to talk about YouTube, because YouTube has become a way that a lot of people listen to music, and YouTube partnerships is actually one of the 42 revenue streams if you register your content, they call it content, not music, your content with YouTube's content ID, you can either choose to remove all music or all YouTube videos that have your work on them from the site. You can just mute the audio if it's just your music that's being incorporated, or you can actually collect, I guess, what amounts to, it sounds like, for the Harlem Shake, which has become this big viral thing recently, the artist Bauer, it amounts to like $2 per 1,000 YouTube views, something like that.
That's not bad.
If you have millions of views, that's pretty awesome.
I mean, when you think about some of the streaming, when you think about some of the streaming income, the Spotify rate is secret, but a lot of people who look at their statements will kind of calculate it out. It'll be like, you know, what is it like, tenths of a penny, or like, you know, 4/10 of a penny or something like that. And so 4/10 of a penny, oh my gosh, I don't know if I can do the math, times 1,000. My mother would be so disappointed in me. But, you know, what does that end up adding up to? And it seems like the basic rate seems not so bad. I mean, it's not as good as terrestrial radio. I mean, like terrestrial radio, people definitely get more per play. But, you know, it's really hard to know what the right amount is going to be, because there's a sweet spot, right? There's a sweet spot of what is going to be enough money so that the artists feel like that it's fair. It's always going to be more than the service can pay. But you know, how much the services want to pay is always going to be too low, too, because, you know, they want to try and minimize their costs as they're trying to get their business off the ground. And ultimately, it's going to be a combination of the music of these artists and the way the service delivers them. I think services do add value. They do create a crowd for music. And so...
Yeah, if YouTube did not exist, then this Harlem Shake phenomenon would not have taken off.
Sure.
I guess it's become the most successful recording on the Mad Decent label, which is pretty cool. Greg, I'm wondering what role, you know, YouTube plays in. I know you've done music videos.
Yeah, I mean, you know, music videos are, you know, still, I think, as they were before, good tools for promotion of the record or of the tour. You know. I mean, my experience is that I basically support myself by playing live. That is for the most part the way that I personally make money. So, as far as YouTube is concerned, that is a promotional tool. It's less something where I would look to try to get revenue from, because I don't, you know. If a music video gets a ton of play or something like that, maybe that would be, it would be cool to monetize that somehow. But it seems in my experience to be more the kind of thing where it's like, you know, videos of that people take of a live performance of the band or something like this, and then that generates excitement, or that's used by another venue to promote the show. It's like, oh, here, check out this link to this video of this. You can expect this, you know, to a certain extent or whatever.
Yeah. It's interesting, you know, the line between the promotional and where if something really takes off, then yeah, it would be cool to get a little bit of revenue from it. But Rebecca, we're also joined by Rebecca Gates via Skype. Is YouTube something that plays into your approach?
No. I'm actually, you know, it's just something that I have that I've invested much time in developing, and that's just it's one of the things that I am aware of, and it's something, it's nice to know that potential is there, and you know, even if it's just pennies. But you know, for me, it's I'm a very strong believer in sound, and even negotiating how much sound and music comes through visual channels these days for me is just philosophically something that I not struggle with, but that I consider. We actually, for a couple reasons, didn't even make a video for the last record, which is ridiculous, but it's just something, you know, it's just sort of how that played out, and a lot of that is me re-entering, working and figuring out where I have capacity and where I can, you know, what I choose to be involved with and how we spend our time and our resources. I listen to YouTube. I think one of the things that's interesting is that you have something like YouTube, where obviously they're building their own brand, and they're building their own business. But they have reached out to try and do these partnership programs, and they are thinking in terms of how to compensate artists. And that's something that I think that there is such a wide range of how different portals are dealing with the question of compensating musicians. And so even something, I just think that that's something that also is important to consider, how granular some of this can get, which is that, you know, there's different ways of considering, even in terms of a digital service positioning themselves as either streaming or as a sales service, and like trying to get different royalties. And I think that you know, I appreciate that YouTube has tried to offer a sort of active partnership with musicians and recognize what, how much of an input they're having as they build that business, where there's other businesses that sort of don't really seem to care much about music, about artist businesses. It's just mostly about stockholders or potential VC funding.
One of the things that, because we meet with a lot of policymakers around our work, because they're all kind of curious to see how artists are doing. And one of the things that's been a source of surprise, or, you know, like people are, they look at it and like, oh, really, is that the case? Is that YouTube money, when we ask people if they receive any of it, I think that the answer was maybe less than 2% of the musicians that we surveyed reported getting any money from YouTube. When we asked people about fan funding, which is another thing, something like Kickstarter or Indiegogo, which I think have been getting a lot of play in the trade press, like people in the music industry like to talk about what are the new big business models going to be. And definitely Kickstarter ends up coming into the equation with the last year, people like Amanda Palmer. But I think that's less than, it's like between 5 and 6% of the musicians that we surveyed reported receiving income from that source. We talk about things like branding opportunities for people, like new kinds of merchandising opportunities. That was one of the first presentations that we did for our project, and it was at Meetem, where they wanted to know like how important is brands to individual artists, and that we found overall that branding related revenue, if you were to count like all merchandise and like persona stuff or any kind of other like clothing lines or things like that, I mean, like they tended to be again a very small percentage of income for individual artists. So you know, before when I was saying that YouTube is 2%, that's 2% of people reported saying that they had that kind of income, and that the fan funding is 5% of people reported saying that they had that kind of income. When it comes to the branding question, it's slightly different. It's that I think it ended up being like 4% of income, if people's income ended up being from branding related stuff. So again, these are very small numbers.
Well, we just have a few minutes left. I want to take some calls. We also have people commenting up at WFMU.org, which is a way to ask a question. And the phone number here is 201-209-9368. And once again, it's 201-209-9368. I want to talk just a little bit more about percentages. There was this study from Peter DiCola, who is a law professor and participated in...
Peter DiCola is part of our research team.
Part of the research team. Mm-hmm. And so just kind of one more example of somebody who's taking this data and analyzing it. He released a paper about how, basically trying to take this data and figure out how copyright incentives, how to determine, you know, whether copyright could be changed to provide more or less incentives, and how copyright seems to play a role in artist revenue streams. So he divided things up into like...
Are you talking about table seven?
Table seven?
Are you talking about table... Because he's got this beautiful table.
Okay.
That I love, which is just like... he divided all the people who took the survey into four categories, right? So like there's jazz, there's classical, there's composers, who, you know, sometimes people would say they were a composer, they wouldn't say what genre they're in, and then everybody else. And that if you took those four categories and then you were like, well, what's the top 1%? Like the top 1% of earners, like how much of their income is copyright related? And then how much of it is, you know, directly related to copyright, indirectly related to copyright, somewhat mixed, kind of related to copyright. And he kind of did that for all of the different income strata for those four different categories. And it's a beautiful chart. I mean, it's a draft of the paper that's available on SSRN right now. It's actually hasn't been published yet. It's going to be published in the spring in the Arizona Law Journal. But it's a beautiful chart because what you get to see there then is that if you do care about copyright, you will see that there are certain categories of musician that we have surveyed that clearly depend on copyright. Like composers, anyone who's earning a lot of money, like the top earners all rely on copyright much more than people who are on the lower end of the earning scale. And then people who are in classical and jazz rely on copyright less. Obviously, composers rely on copyright the most. And they're actually the ones who've been the most vocal about some of the changes that we've seen in the industry. If you pay attention to the policy space, you'll see people like the Songwriters Guild of America, or you'll see Nashville Songwriters Association International talking about how their entire industry has just kind of fallen apart. And for the most part, they're right. I talked about the four different kinds of composers earlier tonight. One of those was a Nashville composer, people who write songs that are hits. Those guys are really taking a big hit right now with the changes that are happening.
It is a real range, and I think that it kind of ranged from the top earners who are also composers. They were earning like 67% from directly related to copyright. I think that was the number. But then if you look at other musicians, it can be as musicians who aren't composers, obviously. It can be a much smaller percentage. We have a question from Andrea, who is also helping out with the program today, saying today the Six Strikes copyright enforcement system went into effect, meaning if you're downloading music or movies on the internet, it's possible that somebody is watching you and they're going to throttle your bandwidth and send you some educational resources. Should musicians expect a huge surge in revenue from that?
No. I doubt it highly.
Why is that, Greg?
Why is that? I mean, should musicians, I don't know, like very famous musicians maybe, like that might, it might like help them more because like those are the people whose stuff is getting pirated the most. But like for people who are kind of like, not famous, pirating helps, I think. To a large degree. It might take a little bit of money out, but we're not making money on record sales. We're making money on performance. So, you know what I mean? That, I don't see that helping me so much or people I know. But, I mean, I don't know. I feel like that actually threatens me more than it does.
Because then it's like the resources that people have to hear music will also kind of be throttled.
Not to mention that that's what I'm,
Rebecca, I'm wondering what your perspective is on Six Strikes.
I mean, it's just one of the, there's been so many clumsy attempts to address the new technology, and from SOPA people all the way to things like this. And there's so many, it's what Gene was addressing in terms of leverage, it's just a different aspect of that. And who has the leverage to affect policy? And that's, it's one of the things that's great about what the future of music does, is that it helps translate what's happening on the Hill out and also going back in, and just having a presence on that on the Hill is so important for independent artist practice. And in terms of, I don't know enough about it to get into it specifically. But I would just say really quickly that I would really be excited if we could start addressing some of these issues less from a punitive point of view and into a more creative addressing what the landscape actually looks like and who's working in it, anything from the Aaron Swartz issues to just policy and piracy issues.
Well, yeah, and the artist revenue streams data seems like a great place to start. It's already... Are we already seeing examples where artist revenue streams is actually informing actual policy?
I think that we are actually. We've been asked to present to a number of policymakers, like whether it be people who work on copyright every day to people who have to deal with copyright every once in a while. They all take this data that we've put together with great interest, because it's just been a hole. If they wanted to understand how things were impacting the music community, they had to rely on reports from people like the Recording Industry Association of America or other kinds of trade groups, or they'd have to rely on maybe music services to give them data about how things are impacting artists. This is really filling a gap for a lot of those folks. I think how it's going to impact policy is that it's going to be it's just that musicians have another seat at the table now, because they do have data they can present on various views. And that, you know, over the next few months, one of the things that I'm particularly excited about is that, you know, it's not just a data set that you write a report and then you file the report away. It's actually this massive set of data that you can filter in so many different ways. So if you wanted to test what new policies would look like, if you wanted to say like, okay, well, is the six strikes thing going to be increasing the musician's bottom line? We can actually take a look and try and figure out, well, how much of the income do musicians receive from the internet? And then who's most likely to benefit from this? You were saying that it's going to be the wealthiest musicians, and that probably is the case because they're the ones who earn the most from copyright-related income. But we would be able to kind of filter out the set that we have to try and better understand how certain things might impact the community.
Well, it's really exciting work, and Gene Cook, co-director of the Artist Revenue Streams Project, thank you so much for joining. Greg Fox, musician, I'm sorry we didn't get into all the music that I wanted to play, Greg, and also Rebecca Gates, thank you very much for joining. I'm going to have to clear the decks for Nardwar, who's coming your way right now. I want to thank everybody for listening, and thanks to National Endowment for the Arts for helping make this program possible. Radio Free Culture, archived up at wfmu.org/playlist/FC. This is WFMU East Orange, WMFU Mount Hope in Rockland County at 91.9 FM and online at wfmu.org.
TV. That and you're listening to WFMU. And it's time right now for the Nardwuar, the Human Serviette radio show. You just heard right there, Frida Payne with I. And you're listening to WFMU. And it's time right now for the Nardwuar, the Human Serviette radio show. You just heard right there a song written by Flying Lotus's grandma, Marilyn McLeod. We're talking Frida Payne's I Get High. And today on the Nardwuar, the Human Serviette radio show, an interview with Flying Lotus. Plus, an interview with Chili Gonzalez. Chili Gonzalez and Flying Lotus. Today on the Nardwuar, the Human Serviette radio show on WFMU. And to get you started, gonna play you something by Flying Lotus's uncle, John Coltrane. We're gonna hear Evolution Part 2, an excerpt of Evolution Part 2 from the Live in Seattle double LP, recorded September 30th, 1965 at the Penthouse in Seattle, Washington. So, right now, here's John Coltrane, Flying Lotus's uncle, with Evolution Part 2. And then an interview with Flying Lotus, and then an interview with Chili Gonzalez. All on the Nardwuar, the Human Serviette radio show on WFMU.